dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Crises are swirling around us, events are unfolding, and policies and programs are being hotly debated. Topics such as whether people shall have universal health care, or torturers be brought to account, or institutions of a faltering economic system be rescued, whether wars be continued or ended, and what to do about the destruction of the natural world. All these are of the utmost importance. Yet I am frustrated with the nature of the debate, because it is not addressing the way these things are connected, and they are. There is even now in our society more broadly a parallel contest, portrayed as a conflict between science and religion. And these are seen as opposites fighting for supremacy, modernity versus morality as characterized by the Abrahamic worldview. But Charles Eisenstein, the author of The Ascent of Humanity, has illuminated the illusory nature of even that difference. Underlying all these things is a worldview, a program of domination and control, of viewing the human being as separate and antagonistic to nature in a struggle for survival, or alternatively, cast out of the Garden of Eden. Eisenstein had begun his book by defining that worldview of domination and control as a central project of what we call civilization. And if we are to devise solutions that truly solve anything, I believe we must go that deep. And therefore, I'm going to devote the entire program this week to just reading from his book, his tour de force, The Ascent of Humanity. Eisenstein believes that we are at the cusp of a new era in human history, when we have reached the limits of a very long process of what he calls separation, and that it is now time to reunite with an identity long abandoned, not as a going backwards, but as a sort of, my words, coming full circle. Let us now continue with The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
I'm looking up where the new perspective. end of you. Please accept my desire to be friends with you. Now I know just how much I depend on you for life. You are my life. You are the life that grows in the flesh I'm weaving. Life that flows in the air I'm breathing. I am strong as a tree on a mountain. Full and fresh as a free-flowing fountain. Bright and clear as the stars beyond counting in the night. I am their light. I am the light.
While hints of the built-in failure of the technological program have been nagging civilization for thousands of years, it's only in the present era that they are becoming undeniable and inescapable. In the past, for instance, the effects of ecological destruction were localized. The rich and the lucky could always move somewhere else, which is in itself a kind of temporary fix as well. Today, as ecosystem collapse becomes global, there is no longer a somewhere else. There is nowhere to go. Even when people retreat into a fortress mentality, our systemic, social, and environmental problems find a way in. In any addiction, the fix appears to work beautifully at first. A servant of life, an easer of pain, coming at a manageable cost. At first, the sacrifices seem worth it. Cast into some corner to be dealt with later. But sooner or later, the cost grows to such proportions as to engulf the whole of life, even as its power to numb the pain diminishes. The technological fix puts off the problem to the future, just as a drinking binge puts off until tomorrow the problems of life. No longer. The future is now, and it will not be put off much longer. The future of the technological program is one where all the problems are solved once and for all, here and now, though we are waking up to an other kind of future, and with a hangover to boot. Vomit on the floor, the apartment trashed, the world a mess. Just as any personal addiction inexorably unravels the fabric of the addict's family, friendships, work, and indeed all relationships to the world, so has our technological addiction slowly destroyed our natural and social environment. As with other addictions, before technology's glittering promise began to fade, such destruction was easy to ignore. The appalling pollution of the 19th century was actually more destructive to human quality of life, though more localized, than pollution today, but was easily dismissed as a temporary problem, a cost of progress that would inevitably be solved through more technology. Today, for many of us, the effects of pollution are more distant, more subtle, and certainly less easily attributable to a single specific cause, but also more systemic and more a threat to the whole of the planet. From ozone layer destruction to global warming, down to the PCBs in every living cell, the destruction today is pervasive, inescapable. The inescapability of the present crisis is demolishing the fundamental illusion beneath the course of separation. As long as we believe ourselves to be discrete beings fundamentally separate from the environment, then in principle there is no limit to our ability to insulate ourselves from the degeneration of the social and natural environment. The world is an other, and its suffering has nothing to do with me, provided I am skillful enough in insulating myself. Today, as the wreckage proliferates, its effects become increasingly difficult to manage. The habitual response is to try harder, to invent new technology to clean up the problems of the old, to insulate ourselves still more skillfully from the mess. But as this becomes impossible, as burgeoning crises overwhelm us, another possibility emerges: to abandon the program of insulation and control and the conception of the separate self on which it rests. The process of addiction recovery described by the 12 Steps program offers an interesting parallel. The first three steps boil down to something like this. We realize that we were powerless over our addiction and that our lives had become unmanageable. Therefore, we made a decision to give our lives and our will over to a higher power. In the context of technology, the first sentence above amounts to an admission of the failure of the technological program. It is the realization that the more we try to manage and control nature, the more unmanageable and uncontrollable our problems become. The second sentence is a statement of surrender to and trust in that which is beyond ourselves. The religious content of the 12 Steps testimony translates in this context to a transcendence of the limiting and delusionary conception of self implicit in our physics and biology, economics and politics, philosophy and religion. The way we relate to the world is written into our most basic mythos, our cosmology, our ontology, belief systems that underlie the superstructures of science and religion. It is our fundamental beliefs about who we are and about the nature of the universe that have generated human life as we know it, and the world as we experience it. If these beliefs remain unchanged, then unchanged as well will be the direction they take us. Our despair, then, is justified. Technology as we know it, and with it the program of control, will never fulfill the promise of the ascent of humanity. But herein also lies a great hope, because from despair comes surrender, and from surrender comes an opening to new beliefs, a new conception of self and the world. From this might come a new way of relating to the world, that is, a new mode of technology no longer dedicated to the objectification, control, and eventual transcendence of nature. The collapse we are facing is of more than our civilization, but of civilization itself, civilization as we know it. It is a collapse of a whole way of relating to the world, a whole way of being, a whole definition of self. For at the root of the technological addiction is our own off-separation from the universe, our self-conception as discrete and separate beings that goads us toward control. Historical civilizations' disintegration were a preview of the archetypal collapse that is overtaking us today, diffracted back onto history. What drives our addiction to technology? Underneath all addictions, there is an authentic need that the addiction promises to meet. The narcotic says, "I will kill the pain." But of course, the promise is a lie that leaves the true need unmet. The same goes for technology, driven by the imperative to control nature, which itself comes as well from an unmet need. It is a need we all feel in different ways, as an anxiety endemic to modern life, as a near universal feeling of meaninglessness, as a relentless ennui from which we can only ever be temporarily distracted, as a pervasive superficiality and phoniness. It is a feeling that something is missing. Some people call it a hole in the soul. What we are seeking in our technological addiction is nothing less than our lost wholeness, and its recovery is what lies on the other side of the imminent collapse of the regime of separation. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. From separation to boredom. The ascent of humanity has come at a price, and I am not speaking here merely of the destruction of the ecological basis of human civilization. Our separation-fueled ascent exacts its toll not just on the losers, the victims of our wars, industry, and ecocide, but on the winners as well. It is the highest of all possible prices. It comes out of our very being. For all we have built on the outside, we have diminished our souls. When we separate ourselves from nature, as we have done with technology, when we replace interdependency with security and trust with control, we separate ourselves as well from part of ourselves. Nature, internal and external, is not a gratuitous, though practical, necessary other, but an inseparable part of ourselves. To attempt its separation creates a wound no less severe than to rip off an arm or a leg, indeed more severe. Under the delusion of the discrete and separate self, we see our relationships as extrinsic to who we are on the deepest level. We see relationships as associations of discrete individuals. But in fact, our relationships with other people and all life define who we are, and by impoverishing these relationships, we diminish ourselves. We are our relationships. Interdependency, which implies a conditional relationship, is far too weak a word for this non-separation of self and other. My claim is much stronger, that the self is not absolute or discrete, but contingent, relationally defined, and blurrily demarcated. There is no self except in relation to the other. The economic man, the rational actor, the Cartesian I am, is a delusion that cuts us off from most of what we are, leaving us lonely and small. Stephen Buhner calls this cleavage the interior wound of separation. Because it is woven into our very self-definition, it is inescapable except through temporary distraction, during which it festers inside, awaiting the opportunity to burst into consciousness. The wound of separation expresses itself in many guises, ranging from petty but persistent dissatisfactions that, when resolved, quickly morph into other, equally petty dissatisfactions, in an endless treadmill of discontent, to the devastating phthisis of hopelessness and despair that quite literally consumes the spirit. Riding any vehicle it can, the pain from the interior wound manifests in a million ways. An omnipresent loneliness, an unreasonable sadness, an undirected rage, a gnawing discontent, a seething resentment. Unaware of its true source, we assign it one or another object, one or another imperfection in the outside world. We then seek to forestall the pain by suppressing its vehicles, getting life under control. In a personalized version of the technological program, we identify happiness with the maximum possible insulation from danger, dirt, and discomfort. But of course, this insulation cuts us off even further from the world and so exacerbates the separation that is the actual source of the pain. As a saying goes, seek not to cover the world in leather, just wear shoes. It is a spiritual cliche that happiness is not to be found by engineering the world so that everything goes your way. Such happiness is transient, doomed. But that's the way we act, culturally and individually, much of the time. Someday, everything will be perfect, and we'll be able to relax and be happy forever. The futility of the personal and collective technological program of complete control finds incontrovertible demonstration in the phenomenon of boredom, which shows us the human condition when the technological program succeeds. What is the ground state, the default state of the human being when everything is under control, when no personal calamity imminently threatens? What happens if we just sit here with nothing to do and nothing that needs to be done? Boredom is so endemic in our culture, particularly among youth, that we imagine it to be a near universal default state of human existence. In the absence of outside stimuli, we are bored. Yet as Ziauddin Sardar observes, boredom is virtually unique to Western culture, and by extension to the global culture it increasingly dominates. Bedouins, he writes, can sit for hours in the desert, feeling the ripples of time without being bored. Whence comes this feeling we call boredom, the discomfort of having nothing to occupy our minds? Boredom, nothing to do, is intolerable because it puts us face to face with a wound of separation. Boredom, that yearning for stimulation and distraction, for something to pass the time, is simply how we experience any pause in the program of control that seeks to deny pain. I am not suggesting that we ignore the causes of pain. Pain is a messenger that tells us, don't do that. And we are wise to heed it. But we step far beyond that when we suppose, even when the wound has been inflicted and the consequent pain written into reality, that we can somehow avoid feeling it. A saying of Chinese Buddhism goes, a bodhisattva avoids the causes. The ordinary person tries to avoid the results. Apparently, boredom was not even a concept before the word was invented around 1760, along with the word interesting. The tide of boredom that has risen ever since coincides with the progress of the Industrial Revolution, hinting at a reason why it has until recently been an exclusively Western phenomenon. The reality that the factory system created was a mass-produced reality, a generic reality of standardized products, standardized roles, standardized tasks, and standardized lives. The more we came to live in that artificial reality, the more separate we became from the inherently fascinating realm of nature and community. Today, in a familiar pattern, we apply further technology to relieve the boredom that results from our immersion in a world of technology. We call it entertainment. Have you ever thought about that word? To entertain a guest means to bring him into your house. To entertain a thought means to bring it into your mind. To be entertained means to be brought into the television, the game, the movie. It means to be removed from yourself and the real world. When a television show does this successfully, we applaud it as entertaining. Our craving for entertainment points to the impoverishment of our reality. All the causes of boredom are permutations of the interior wound of separation. Aside from the impoverishment of our reality, we are uncomfortable doing nothing because of the relentless anxiety that dominates modern life. This, in turn, arises from the paradigm of competition that underlies our socioeconomic structures, which, as I will explain in Chapter 4, is written into our conception of self. Second, we desire constant stimulation and entertainment because in their absence, we are left alone with ourselves with nothing to distract us from the pain of the wound of separation. Finally, technology contributes directly to the boredom by bombarding us with a constant barrage of intense stimuli, habituating our brains to a high level of stimulation. When it is removed, we suffer withdrawal. We are addicted to the artificial human realm we have created with technology. Now we are condemned to maintain it. that we have unprocessed pain inside us, waiting for any empty moment so that it may assert itself and be felt, is not so surprising given that a main imperative of technology is to maximize pleasure, comfort, and security, and to prevent pain. The urge to make life easier, safer, more convenient, and more comfortable has motivated technology from its inception. When the inventor of the Levallois flintworking technique produced his first spearhead, his contemporaries enthusiastically adopted it because it made life easier. Not nearly so much work now to produce each spearhead. The new technique was so much more efficient. Life got easier. Need I cite more examples? Today we go to the pharmacy cabinet to apply technology to the alleviation of any discomfort, no matter how minor. Have a hangover? Take an aspirin. Have a runny nose? Take a cold medicine. Depressed? Have a drink. The underlying assumption is that pain is something that need not be felt, and the ultimate fulfillment of technology would be to discover the means to eliminate pain and suffering forever. Maximizing pleasure and eliminating pain is the goal of the technological program taken to its logical extreme. An articulation of this goal in fairly pure form is David Pearce's hedonistic imperative, which advocates the total elimination of suffering through genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and neurochemistry by disabling pain receptors, stimulating pleasure centers, and so on, as foreshadowed by today's happy drugs, but also by the entire medical apparatus that seeks to remove or palliate symptoms. The mood-altering drugs, most notably the selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, are applied on the premise that the real cause of mental anguish is low levels of serotonin and norepinephrine in the brain. Raise the levels of these neurotransmitters and the anguish goes away. The treatment is a success. Underneath the assumption the pain need not be felt lie some even deeper assumptions. One of these is disconnection. The low serotonin levels are viewed in isolation from a patient's whole being, like a car with a broken part. This mechanistic paradigm denies the organic nature of a body, in which the health of any part reflects the health of the whole. It denies that there are reasons for the low serotonin, and the reasons for the reasons, and the reasons for those, spreading out to encompass the patient's whole being. Related to disconnection is a further assumption, that we live in a dead and purposeless universe. Events happen essentially at random. There is no orchestrating purpose to make each event significant and right. Depression did not serve a higher purpose, because there is no such thing as a higher purpose. No reason except the identifiable mechanistic reason. And therefore, no cause to expect the pain will return in another form when this avenue is blocked. Reality is infinitely manageable. If, however, we see technology, both on the personal and the collective level, as a means not to eliminate pain but to defer it, then it stands to reason that it will be waiting for us at any empty moment. All the more so if the very effort to defer pain generates new pain. The new problems caused by the previous technology, the symptoms caused by the drug itself. In a connected, purposeful universe, managing the pain is like patching a leaky pipe when the water pressure is too high. Fixing one leak ensures another will spring elsewhere. Meanwhile, the pressure keeps rising. The apparatus of civilization springs one leak after another as frantically we try to seal the spreading cracks. It has been said in a Judaic-Christian-Islamic context that the separation from God, the fall, is the source of all suffering. Buddhism names attachment as the cause of all suffering, but careful examination reveals its teaching to be nearly identical to that of the esoteric Western religion. Attachment to the impermanent, delusory ego self and all those things that reinforce it, maintains a separation from the rest of the universe from which we are not actually separate. Attachment is separation. As for separation from God, what is God but that which transcends our separate selves and interpenetrates all being? On the origin of suffering, Eastern and esoteric Western religion are in fundamental agreement. In every human life, happiness and security come from strong connections to family, community, nature, place, spirit, and self. And not from independence, whether psychological or financial. Because the story of technology is one long saga of widening separation from nature, widening separation from community, because of specialization and the mass scale of society, widening separation from place, because of our highly mobile and indoor-centered lifestyles, and widening separation from spirit because of the dominant scientific paradigms of the Newtonian world machine, it is no wonder that the pain of the human condition has only grown throughout the modern era. Even as outright physical hardship has declined, psychological suffering in the form of loneliness, despair, depression, anxiety, angst, and anger has grown to epidemic proportions. Even when our technology succeeds in holding off the external consequences of our separation, we still internalize it as a wound, a separation from our own souls. A final indication of the nature of the wound lies in the phenomenon of greed. When I ask my students the source of global problems such as pollution, they invariably cite greed, which they see as a fundamental characteristic of human nature that can be controlled but never eliminated. But greed, like boredom, is absent in most hunter-gatherer cultures based on a more open conception of self. Acquisitiveness is merely another attempt to fill the void and assuage the ache of separation, as if the accretion of more and more self in the form of possessions could compensate for the profound denial of self that is separation. Tellingly, we often use acquisitive metaphors for the way we distract ourselves from the existential unease we call boredom. Have a cigarette, have a drink, have something to do. It is by having, as well, that we strive for security, whether material, having possessions, or interpersonal, to the extent of having sex. But of course, no matter how much accrues to the discrete and separate self, that self is still fundamentally alone in the universe. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. From boredom to anxiety. He must be cut off from the past, because it is necessary for him to believe that he is better off than his ancestors, and that the average level of material comfort is constantly rising. George Orwell, 1984. So complete is our identification of boredom as the default state of human existence that when asked to define it, most people say, boredom is when there is nothing to do. That this is an unpleasant state is by no means a logical necessity. Not only pre-modern people, but the entire animal kingdom seems to be perfectly fine with inactivity. This observation calls into question one of the fundamental tenets of the conventional explanation of the history of technology, which Stephen Buhner calls the anxiety theory in the context of the invention of brewing. More broadly, the concept is that human technological progress, in general, is driven by the struggle to survive, and that this struggle, this precariousness of existence, expresses itself in the human organism's physiology and psychology as anxiety, which is eased by creating better means to survive. Anxiety, then, is the way that threats to survival are translated into action to mitigate those threats. We can restate the anxiety theory as follows. 1. Life is dangerous and survival difficult. 2. This makes us feel anxious. 3. The unpleasantness of this feeling drives us to control the dangerous, difficult circumstances, for example, through technology. We now feel less anxious. On an individual level, the anxiety theory purports to explain boredom as follows. We really cannot afford to sit there and do nothing. If life is a competition for survival, then our genes should drive us to make the best possible use of each moment to augment our chances of survival and reproduction. Sitting around doing nothing goes against our genetic programming, which generates a feeling of discomfort that impels us to do something productive. Certainly, this is what many people feel during empty moments or deliberate experiments at meditation. A churning unease that says, I should be doing something. This cultural compulsion is so strong that even spiritual practices such as meditation and prayer are easily converted into just another thing to do, moments mortgaged to the campaign of improving life. Is the anxiety theory true? Ask some random people on the street, and you will find that most would not want to go back to a primitive life before technology. We assume a dark picture of the primitive life as an uncomfortable, never-ending struggle for existence. This assumption is at the root of our cultural belief that technology has rescued us from the caprices of nature and enabled us to develop our higher potential. Here we have, in a nutshell, the ascent of humanity. The main problem with this view is that life in the Stone Age was not necessarily nasty, brutish, and short at all. Ethnographic studies of isolated Stone Age hunter-gatherers and pre-modern agriculturalists suggest that, quote, primitive peoples, far from being driven by anxiety, lived lives of relative leisure and affluence. An oft-cited example is the Kung of the Kalahari Desert in southern Africa, who were studied by the anthropologist Richard Lee. He followed them around for 4 weeks, kept a log of all their activities, and calculated an average work week of approximately 20 hours spent in subsistence activities. This figure was confirmed by subsequent studies by Lee and other researchers in the same region. In one of the harshest climates in the world, the Kung enjoyed a leisurely life with a high nutritional intake. This compares to the modern standard of 40 hours of work per week. If we add in commuting time, shopping, housework, cooking, and so forth, the typical American spends about 80 hours per week aside from leisure time, eating and sleep. The comparable figure for the Kung is 40 hours, including such necessary activities as making tools and clothes. Other studies worldwide, as well as common sense, suggest that the Kung were not exceptional. In more lush areas, life was probably even easier. Moreover, much of the work spent on these 20 hours of subsistence activities was by no means strenuous or burdensome. Most of the men's subsistence hours were spent hunting, something we do for recreation today, while gathering work was occasion for banter and frequent breaks. Primitive small-scale agriculturalists enjoyed a similar unhurried pace of life. Consider Helena Norbert Hodge's description of pre-modern Ladakh, a region in the Indian portion of the Tibetan Plateau. Despite a growing season only 4 months long, Ladakh enjoyed regular food surpluses, long and frequent festivals and celebrations, and ample leisure time, especially in winter when there was little field work to do. This, despite the harsh climate and the proportionately enormous population of non-working Buddhist monks in that country's numerous monasteries. More powerfully than any statistic, Norberg Hodge's video documentary Ancient Futures conveys a sense of the leisurely pace of life there. Villagers chat or sing as they work. Plenty of long breaks, even at the busiest time of year. As the narrator says, Work and leisure are one. Living in today's depleted world, it's hard to imagine its original bounty. Early European accounts of this continent's opulence border on the unbelievable. Time and again we read of goodly woods full of deer, conies, hares, and fowl, even in the middest of summer, in an incredible abundance of islands as completely covered with birds, which nest there as a field covered with grass, of rivers so full of salmon that at night one is unable to sleep, so great is the noise they make. They describe rivers so thick with fish that they could be taken not only with a net, but in baskets let down and weighted with a stone. These and other wonders, flocks of passenger pigeons and Eskimo curlews, both now extinct, that darkened the sky for days, comprised the provenance of this continent's native inhabitants. How much of a struggle could life have been? Note as well that this cornucopia existed despite humans having inhabited the continent for at least 12,000 years. It was not as if the Native Americans hadn't sufficient time to deplete nature's resources. We cannot conclude that their attitude of easy abundance was a temporary consequence of rich natural capital. Their relationship with nature also preserved and sustained that abundance. More significant than the actual time spent on subsistence was the hunter-gatherer's attitude toward subsistence, which was generally relaxed and nonchalant. As Marshall Salins describes, quote, "The hunter adopts a studied unconcern, which expresses itself in two complementary economic inclinations. The first, prodigality, the propensity to eat right through all the food in the camp, even during objectively different times. As if, Lillian said of the Montagnier, the game they were to hunt was shut up in a stable." Basedow wrote of native Australians, their motto might be interpreted in words to the effect that while there is plenty for today, never care about tomorrow. On this account, an Aboriginal inclined to make one feast of his supplies in preference to a modest meal now and another by and by. A second and complementary inclination is merely prodigality's negative side. The failure to put by food surpluses, to develop food storage. For many hunters and gatherers, it appears, food storage cannot be proved technically impossible, nor is it certain that people are unaware of the possibility. One must investigate instead what in this situation precludes the attempt. Gusind asked this question, and for the Yagan found the answer in the selfsame justifiable optimism. Storage would be superfluous, because through the entire year and with almost limitless generosity, the she puts all kinds of animals at the disposal of the man who hunts and the woman who gathers. Storm or accident will deprive a family of these things for no more than a few days. Generally, no one need reckon with the danger of hunger, and everyone almost anywhere finds an abundance of what he needs. Why, then, should anyone worry about food for the future? Basically, our Fuegians know that they need not fear for the future, hence they do not pile up supplies. Year in and year out, they can look forward to the next day, free of care. Close quote. Significantly, Aboriginal peoples typically refer to food as a gift from the land, the forest, or the sea. To us moderns, it is a charming metaphor. To pre-agricultural people, the providence of the earth was a living reality. The land provides all things. Plants grow, animals are born, without the necessity of human effort or planning. Gifts are not something that must be earned. To see life in terms of receiving gifts bespeaks an attitude of abundance and naturally fosters a mentality of gratitude. Only with agriculture did the freely received gifts of the land become objects of exchange. First, an exchange of work for harvest, and eventually the objects of commerce. In contrast, the mentality of the gift corresponds to the forager's nonchalance, which makes sense when the necessities of life are provided and not extracted. Maybe we can still rescue the anxiety theory. What about disease? When I ask students to identify the most valuable achievements of modern technology, they invariably point to medicine, which they claim has given us levels of health, security, and longevity unprecedented in history. Such a view, however, fails to recognize the power and sophistication of traditional herbal medicine for curing the wounds and diseases common in those times. It must also contend with the observations of Weston Price, an American dentist who lived in the early 20th century. Price was curious about the decline of dental health he'd seen over the decades of his practice, and hypothesized that the rapid increase in the prevalence of tooth decay, crowded dentition, and a host of other formerly rare non-dental maladies had something to do with our diets. He quit his practice and spent many years traveling to remote corners of the world where people still lived without modern foods. The societies he visited weren't all Stone Age, but they were primitive by our standards. He went to remote Swiss villages accessible only by mule, and to the outer islands of Scotland. He lived with the Maasai in Africa, the Inuit in Alaska, the Aborigines in Australia, Polynesians in the Pacific. In all these places, he found almost no tooth decay, no obesity, no heart disease, and no cancer. Instead, he observed magnificent physical stamina, easy childbirth, and broad jaws with all 32 teeth. The diets were different everywhere, but there were some things in common. People ate very few refined carbohydrates, plenty of live fermented food, and substantial quantities of fats and organ meats. Their vitamin intake was many times greater than the norm today. Price's work lends support to the contention that at least in some respects, primitive people enjoyed better health than is the norm today, even without the modern medicine that we think keeps us healthy. I don't mean to idealize life before modern technology. Certainly, we were more subject to the elements, heat, cold, rain, and wind. In Ladakh, people were cold a lot in the wintertime. For the Kung, at certain times of the year, the best foods were hard to come by, and people would typically lose a few pounds over the dry season. Sometimes people would be hungry. While infectious diseases were rare in the days before high concentrations of population, and degenerative diseases rare before the advent of industrial food processing, other threats to life and limb abounded. Sometimes a child would be killed by a lion or hyena. The Kung, a peaceful and sharing people, even experienced occasional homicide, usually sparked by sexual jealousy, resulting in intermittent blood feuds spanning decades. In other parts of the globe, hunter-gatherer tribes lived in a state of constant low-level warfare with occasional outbreaks of horrendous violence, or so it is claimed. Most famous are the tribes of the New Guinea highlands, with reported adult male mortality rates from violence of 20-30%, and the Yanomamo Indians of the Amazon, immortalized by Napoleon Chagnon in his book Yanomamo, the Fierce People. Chagnon claims that these living ancestors lived in a state of perpetual warfare in which some 44% of adult males have killed. Others maintain that his figures are greatly exaggerated. A lot is at stake. Perhaps violence is coded into our genes. Chagnon's mentor, geneticist James Neal, thought that modern culture, with its supportive interventions on behalf of the weak, was dysgenic. It had strayed too far from humankind's original population structures, small, relatively isolated tribal groups where men competed with one another violently for access to women. In these societies, Neal assumed, the best fighters would have the most wives and children and pass on more of their genetic index of innate ability to the next generation, leading to a continual upgrading of the quality of the gene pool. Have we ascended from a Hobbesian past of violence and fear? How else can we interpret the warlike nature of so many of the primitive peoples we have encountered? Is our species consigned to perpetual war until we have, through culture, overcome the genetic programming of the dominating demonic males? In fact, in a pattern that is typical, the violence Shinyan encountered sprung in large part from the disruptions initiated by Western contact and, ironically, from his own presence. Investigative journalist Patrick Tierney writes, Kenneth Good, who worked with Shinyan while researching his PhD, has lived among the Yanomami for 12 years, longer than any American anthropologist. Good calls Shinyan a hit-and-run anthropologist who comes into villages with armloads of machetes to purchase cooperation for his research. Unfortunately, he creates conflict and division wherever he goes. Tierney continues, quote, in 1995, Brian Ferguson, an anthropologist at Rutgers University, published a book entitled Yanomami Warfare, A Political History, which challenged the sociobiological theories drawn from The Fierce People and other studies by Shinyan. Ferguson, whose book analyzes hundreds of sources, wrote that most of the Yanomami wars on record were caused by outside disturbances, particularly by the introduction of steel goods and new diseases. Ferguson noted that axes and machetes became highly coveted among the Yanomami as agricultural tools and as commodities for trade. In his account, evangelical missionaries who arrived in Yanomami territory during the 50s inadvertently plunged the region into war when they dispersed axes and machetes to win converts. In time, some of the missions became centers of stability and sources of much-needed medicine. But Shinyan, whose study of Yanomami mortality rates took him from village to village, dispensed steel goods in order to persuade the people to give him the names of their dead relatives, a violation of tribal taboos. These methods destabilized the region, in effect, promoted the sort of warfare that Shinyan attributed to the Yanomami's ferocity. Close quote. This may be an extreme example, but the principle is clear. It is very difficult to know what any society was like pre-contact. The effects of Western technology, germs, and commerce typically precede the first anthropologists to even the most remote regions, initiating a social breakdown. The same goes for non-humans. As primatologist Margaret Power demonstrates, the murderous behavior of chimpanzees in the wild, cited as evidence of our innate badness, emerges only in disturbed populations, which, strictly speaking, are the only ones accessible to researchers. Specifically, the methods that researchers use to reduce mobility and generate conflict. When we see the warlike nature of primates and primitives, we may be seeing mostly our own shadow. The debate over primitive savagery goes back at least to Rousseau's noble savage versus Hobbes' nasty, brutish, and short state of nature. It rages on today. I leave the question to anthropologists, but one thing is clear. Death, whether by human or natural agency, was a very visible part of life in primitive times. Death and discomfort are less visible today, but this does not mean we have conquered them. We have only hidden them away. Perhaps, even if Hobbes was right, our ascent is an illusion. Nature, too, can be cruel, at least from our present perspective. What of those millions of tadpoles devoured by fish before they can ever enjoy the pleasures of froghood? Most animals have natural predators, except for a few top carnivores and the hugest herbivores who must face their own brand of uncertainty. The technological program notwithstanding, life at all levels is inherently uncertain. Yet somehow, the rest of the animal kingdom does not seem beset by anxiety. Animals spend lots of time grooming, playing, and just loafing around. Do birds really need to spend all that time singing to find a mate and establish territory? Even bees, the epitome of busyness, spend lots of time in the hive, apparently doing nothing at all. The unnaturalness of constant anxiety is also written into our physiology, which is not designed to handle constant stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system and its stress hormones. We have evolved to handle conditions of general leisure and relaxation, punctuated by the occasional burst of emergency overdrive. Many physiological functions, such as digestion, tissue building, and immunity, operate only under conditions of relaxation. The stress we consider normal interferes with them and damages our health. A final indication that anxiety is not, in fact, the default state of human existence lies in the relative lack of anxiety among cultures today that, while certainly not primitive, are nonetheless incompletely integrated into the Western social model. Go to nearly any third world country and you will find that, in the absence of outright war or intense civil unrest, people are generally more laid back, less anxious, less driven, and less competitive than they are here. As the old joke goes, in Mexico, everything is done mañana. In Taiwan, where modernity has come so fast that the old-time agrarian society is still visible in the person of the eldest generation, shoulder to shoulder with a youth culture of cell phones and fast food, traces of the slower pace of life that once existed are still visible. Whereas Chinese New Year is now a 5-day or even a 3-day holiday, in the old days it lasted 2 weeks. Other festivals were similarly extended and required lengthy preparation of costumes and foods that are simply purchased in stores today. And every day, an extended siesta broke apart the workday. Whether in Taiwan or anywhere in the world, the pace of life in the more traditional parts of the country, the American South, for example, is much slower, less pressured, and more leisurely. Extrapolating backward, we may surmise that this, and not anxiety, represents the actual default state of human existence. Witness the following description of the work attitudes of a group of South American hunter-gatherers. Quote, "The Yamana are not capable of continuous daily hard labor, much to the chagrin of European farmers and employers for whom they often work. Their work is a matter of fits and starts, and in these occasional efforts they can develop considerable energy for a certain time. After that, however, they show a desire for an incalculably long rest period, during which they lie about and do nothing without showing a great fatigue. It is obvious that repeated irregularities of this kind make the European employer despair, but the Indian cannot help it. It is his natural disposition." Close quote. A racist interpretation of this passage is easily remedied by acknowledging the sneaking suspicion that this is our natural disposition too. Their work is a matter of fits and starts. Does not that describe a child as well? Reader, do you sometimes feel the desire to rest, even when you're not actually tired? That our actual behavior contradicts our natural disposition testifies to the power of our acculturation. We have been convinced that we cannot afford to live like that, and so we condition ourselves and our children to override their natural disposition and work hard.